there's a degree that our success at disruption may effectively lead to actors having, you know, fewer big brands to defend, right? So if you have to rebrand, if a small team of actors develop their own service, their own name, they're less bound by any of these norms that a larger organization may have adopted to sort of halt disruption efforts targeting the sort of network.
Welcome to another episode of Mandiant's Defenders Advantage podcast. I'm your host, Luke McNamara. Joining me for today's episode, we have Kimberly Goody, who heads our cybercrime analysis team here at Mandiant, and Jeremy Kennelly, the lead analyst on that team. Kimberly, Jeremy, great to have you back again.
Appreciate you having us here.
So I think when we talked last year, we tried to do an episode that was going to be focused on cybercrime trends and activity that was not ransomware and extortion. And I think we inevitably found ourselves back in that category, and we discussed that anyways. This year, we're not going to even try that. We're going to make this an episode around what we're seeing in the multifaceted extortion space. But I think where we can kind of begin this conversation is, if you look at some of the different data sets for 2022, I think we saw either if you're looking at the data leak sites, you know, rather flat year in terms of activity, the numbers of victims. If you look at specifically our the number of breach investigations we did, I think it was actually down a little bit. I don't think we saw that last year in 2023. I think we saw an uptick at least on both those fronts. So maybe we can start there. Just what did we see in depth in last year and how that compared to the changing landscape in the criminal ecosystem?
Yeah, 2022 was really an anomalous year for ransomware activity because we had simultaneously the invasion of Ukraine starting along with the leaked chat data associated with arguably the most prolific ransomware operation at that time. And both of those events, which occurred towards the beginning of 2022, really upended the cybercrime ecosystem. And that resulted in some actors who kind of shifted their operations to align with state interests, either out of necessity or acts of patriotism, as well as significant fracturing of some of these existing prolific ransomware groups. And 2023 was really a different story because we saw these threat actors reconstituting their operations, and the attacks actually rose again to 2021 levels. And in some cases, depending on the metrics that you look at, actually surpass them. Three of the ways that we can really look at this are via the ransomware payments that companies are paying out, the data leak sites, the number of victims that are being posted on those, and then also our own number of incident response engagements that Mandiant is seeing year over year. And to start off here, Chainalysis put out a really great report in February. They noted that ransom payments reached a new record high of $1 billion in 2023. And I actually went and looked to put this into some perspective, like, okay, what companies out there are making $1 billion a year? And so, you know, just for a point of reference for the rest of you, we have companies like Shake Shack and Planet Fitness, right? Those are two very well-known companies, and ransomware actors are making as much as those companies are in terms of revenue each year, which is pretty phenomenal if you think about it. We also can look at this from the victims on data leak sites. This was at an all-time high, at least from the sites that we monitored. We saw over a 75% increase in comparison to the number of victims in 2022. And then the number of ransomware incident response investigations that we did in 2023 did surpass 2021 levels. And so we're seeing this come like full circle back around. So we had that little bit of a dip, but you know, in 2023, we're right back at where we kind of left off in 2021.
And just real quickly on the payment piece, you're talking about that from the total amount that were paid out as part of a ransomware or data theft extortion. Was there any change in the average ransom payment according to Chainalysis data for that time?
Yeah, they're actually seeing the average ransom payments increase. So they looked at it as a the percent of ransom payments that were over $1 million was a significantly higher proportion than the ransom payments that were below that. And if I'm remembering correctly, I think it was perhaps somewhere around 60 plus percent of ransom payments were over $1 million.
Yeah, kind of weaving back to the topic we've been talking about previously, it's, you know, we're using these two, like a number of different sources to gauge and sort of like tell the story about how much this is increasing in prevalence or not, right? So there's sort of credible third-party reporting like Chainalysis, there's the shaming sites themselves and our own data. A lot of the way that people are analyzing this data sort of in isolation is based exclusively on those shaming sites. So it's incredibly important to sort of understand it in this broader context, because the shaming site data itself is really skewed in a number of ways. So there's sort of underlying patterns that could be occurring, such as a decrease in payment in how frequent payments are being made, or sort of shifts from ransomware to purely extortion activity where no ransomware is actually being deployed, that aren't going to be apparent based on that exclusively as a data source. So it's important to incorporate additional data such as sort of payment data and intrusion data. So, you know, looking at our own data in this case does support that thesis, despite a notable amount of what's on those shaming sites, you know, actually being cases where ransomware may never have been deployed.
There's two things I've noticed too in looking at those data sets. I think first, for every quarter going as far back as I can think, manufacturing as an industry seems disproportionately represented in comparison to other sectors. And it also seems to, you know, for the data that we keep around the size of organizations, and this is probably very unsurprising, the victims that show up on those data sites tend to skew towards smaller organizations, sub 1,000 or sub 500 employees, which you would think is probably being, you know, less security resourced and maybe softer targets to go after. But just curious your thoughts on either of those stats or other stats that we've kept around data leak site victims.
Yeah, just touching on the manufacturing piece of it, right? I think that this is actually, as you say, this is a trend that goes back to even the very beginning of when we saw data leak sites cropping up. There's always been trends of certain industries being targeted more frequently, and I think in looking at a lot of those industries, the sort of theory that I tend to try to apply to this that sort of makes a reasonable story is that a lot of the industries that are hit disproportionately are ones that historically, so going back 5, 6, 7 years, were not natural targets for either financially motivated criminals from back when the ecosystem was highly focused on targeting payment cards, or many sort of nation state attackers. So these are organizations that, you know, in the same way you see it potentially skewing to smaller organizations that have fewer security resources, there are organizations who historically were in industries that would have applied fewer resources towards security as to not being sort of the natural victims for any of the predators that were in the ecosystem, you know, historically.
Yeah, I think it also makes sense that that's a sector, speaking in very broad and general terms here, but one that is very, I think, probably sensitive to any downtimes. So thinking about especially the impact from disruption of operations from something like ransomware, even if it's not impacts to things on the factory floor, impacts to being able to ship out or receive orders, you know, those are sectors or entities within that sector that are can probably put a much clearer kind of price tag to any sort of downtime. So that might be something that also plays at some point into the calculus of some of these threat actors.
Yeah, and presumably, like, if they haven't been one of the largest targets for all time, but organizations in the healthcare sector have increasingly become targets for certain threat actors. And we know that's why, right? We know that it is an availability issue.
So let's talk a little bit about the more popular initial infection vectors. This is something that we also study, I think, in some of the reporting that you guys do, but then also in our soon-to-be release M-Trends report, looking kind of across all threat activity. But specific to this sort of extortive activity, what are we seeing with respect to initial infection vectors, how threat actors are breaking in, oftentimes selling that access to another threat actor to carry out operations? What are we seeing in that space?
This year, the most common initial infection vector that we saw was exploitation via some sort of vulnerability. That was closely followed by threat actors using stolen credentials. Those stolen credentials could come from a prior malware infection, or could come from things such as a phishing page that is collecting, let's say, VPN credentials for a particular organization. And then we still do, as you kind of referenced, see a lot of cases where threat actors are acquiring access from a distinct threat actor. And we're always seeing actors on underground communities still seeking partners to provide initial access or to distribute malware on their behalf for ransomware operations, as well as actors who are selling access to companies. And in some of those cases where actors are selling access, for example, they may be providing credentials that they have stolen that then allow that second threat actor to gain access. So being able to measure how often access is provided by a distinct threat cluster, it can get a little bit complicated. And it's probably more common than we actually realize, since threat actors are really piecemealing out a lot of these operations in kind of that like assembly mode, rather than doing the full compromise end to end.
And you noted, you know, the usage of exploits being the most prevalent tactic. A lot of that, I imagine, are exploits that, you know, are end days, or they've been around for some period of time. But we did also see last year some financially motivated threat actors involved in extortion, most notably FIN11, involved in zero-day, you know, usage in their compromise of MOVE-IT. So it seems like there is also those threat actors that maybe have more resources to put towards either acquiring zero days or vulnerability research to find, you know, exploitation through these means. What do you kind of make of that trend?
Well, the FIN11 issue is a particularly interesting one, because it's sort of, they sort of fall out of the normal pattern of sort of ransomware operations, since it's not strictly ransomware, right? That's the exploitation of an internet-facing vulnerability to extract data without needing to deploy ransomware. So from that perspective, they kind of sit, although they're a group that still has very close ties to that entire ecosystem, they've kind of like shifted their mode of operation. So that's one thing to kind of keep in mind. But I think that it also does somewhat align with the observation you made earlier about schemes targeting, disproportionately smaller organizations, right? So these are organizations that are going to then be more likely to, you know, put vulnerable systems on the internet without sort of having the monitoring programs in place to understand when something they're hosting is vulnerable to either end-day vulnerability of some kind, and are simply not going to be able to defend themselves against those sorts of attacks. So that, you know, they're then sort of disproportionately going to be victimized by the actors that are engaging in that scheme more generally.
So Kimberly, you were referencing earlier the impact in 2022 to some of the ransomware and extortion operations, and referenced the Conti leaks. And that was something that had an impact on that ecosystem and probably played into the diminished activity we saw overall the year previous. When we look back into 2023 in particular, we saw, you know, some law enforcement actions, we saw some takedowns, we saw varying levels of, I think, you know, for most of, again, quarter over quarter last year, Lockbit was kind of the predominant ransomware and data leak site, or the more prolific one, but we saw variation with others, and we've seen obviously law enforcement action towards that as well. Zooming out and kind of looking at all these different activities specific to last year, what are your thoughts on ones that have had more longevity and impact in terms of the types of enforcement and takedown activity?
I think overall, the ones that are having the most impact are the ones that are not focused necessarily on a single element. So to put that into perspective, it began the operation in mid-2022, but I think it wasn't really publicized until either the very end or beginning of 2023. when law enforcement took action against the HiBlocker ransomware operation. At that time, when they made that announcement, we learned that they had effectively been sitting there for months, actually providing decryption keys to victims in the back end. And they were able to, based on their estimates, prevent over $100 million in ransom payments to the HiBlocker operation, which was great. They also were able to, you know, in the end, seize these servers. But I bring this up because it wasn't a case where, for example, they gained access to the infrastructure and shut the infrastructure down. They were actually being kind of proactive in the back end to ensure that they were having a positive impact while they continued their investigation. If we look at kind of a more recent example where there were also a lot of elements, we can take the recent actions that law enforcement took to disrupt the LockBit ransomware as a service. And this isn't to say LockBit is still active, unfortunately, but this is another case where they took a kind of multifaceted approach. They were able to take down servers, seize the LockBit data leak site. They also froze a couple hundred cryptocurrency accounts, made some arrests, filed 5 indictments. And they also, in that case, were able to provide victims with decryption keys. But I bring this up because these are cases where I think the impact is a little bit more notable. While LockBit, you know, continues to be active, we have seen threat actors in underground communities who were using LockBit before actually say that they're no longer using it as a result of this news and these actions that have been taken. And so you can see that there's this reputational impact to these threat actors as well, because actors are, you know, maybe inclined to use a brand that doesn't have, you know, this potential infiltration of LockBit. Like the operators of it really need to do some convincing to their affiliates that they have fixed these issues. Otherwise, there are so many alternatives out there for these actors to use that they're just going to shift. And that's typically, you know, unfortunately, what we do see after these law enforcement actions.
And by contrast, I think the cases where it's less effective is where the sort of law enforcement or public sector, private sector response is much more laser focused on one particular aspect of the organization, right? So there were, historically, there have been sort of arrests touted for members of the sort of CLOP ransomware operation, which ended up ultimately being folks operating only on the periphery of that organization, supporting the money laundering function for them. So that at the time had, you know, from the outside, at least, very little impact. The same sorts of things occur when there are reports of that of a takedown, which ultimately ends up being limited to something like seizing a data leak site or seizing access to a wallet or a piece of infrastructure. And so I think that to a degree, although everything helps in that it helps to develop or sort of apply sort of a cooling effect, you know, the same sorts of things Kimberly was saying, where actors are sort of less likely to involve themselves with an organization that has a history of being targeted by law enforcement. You know, the degree to which that impact is successful still needs to override their innate desire to make a lot of money for very little effort.
The reputational impact piece, I think, is interesting because, you know, Kimberly, as you note, there's a lot of alternatives out there. If you're someone who's involved in this ecosystem and you're working with one, you know, partner or one family of ransomware, one data leak site, there's certainly other alternatives you can move to. And I can understand certainly the calculus behind if there's suspicions that one of these networks is infiltrated and that presents higher risk, why they would cause like migration to others. One of the other areas where I'm curious your thoughts around reputational impact. You know, Jeremy, you mentioned healthcare earlier, and I think we're kind of in this, you know, recording this in early 2024, where there's a discussion around, you know, are we seeing more tolerance to go after healthcare providers than ever before? And historically, it seemed like you could point to at least some of these ecosystems and groups and actors that certainly were more risk averse when it came to doing anything in that space because of the law enforcement attention that it drew. But do you think we're kind of seeing that wear off, where there's more threat actors that there's certainly always been a group that has been fine going after healthcare and certainly had no problems with that. But do you think we're seeing more threat actors say maybe, you know, it's worth the risk, or I don't think it's going to have, you know, blowback effects on me as an actor to go out and be involved in somewhat in the targeting of healthcare ecosystems?
You know, I don't necessarily have data to say point blank whether or not the targeting of healthcare sector has definitively increased or decreased. But one example that I would point to recently that is kind of interesting is that when law enforcement took some actions against the Alfie ransomware operation pretty recently, we actually saw them, rather than kind of like back down, they were actively encouraging their affiliates to go after healthcare as kind of this retaliatory measure in their mind. One thing that I would also point to is that, and I don't know how much this actually impacts the way that threat actors are thinking or were thinking, but perhaps why, you know, maybe a couple years ago we saw more of this intolerance, specifically whenever, you know, we were looking at these underground forum posts and actors saying like these industries are off limits, is we do have to remember at that time too, we were like in the midst of this global pandemic. And there, you know, I like to think that like, even though that these are criminals, they may not be completely heartless. At least some of them. And so there may have been some elements of that might have also impacted some of those rules that seemingly existed more stringently back then than they do today.
And you think in some cases too, when there are attempts to do things like takedowns or disruptions, going after an industry like healthcare is a sort of gloves off moment that we're seeing maybe potentially, again, you know, Alfie being one example, in which these threat actors are willing to behave a lot more aggressively where in the past they had more restraint.
Yeah, I think overall you do see threat actors kind of taking this more aggressive approach whenever there is something that happens against them. You saw that too with Conti when they kind of posted that announcement at the start of the war in Ukraine, where they basically said, you know, we are going to come after you if you try to impact or go after Russia, right? And so I think for some threat actors, maybe in some ways are thinking that this is kind of their way to push back against the disruptions that law enforcement is trying to take against them as a way to try to maybe prevent them from taking these actions. However, I would argue that obviously is likely going to have the inverse effect, right? Because that, at least, you know, from my perspective, depending on the industries that you go after, is going to make at least citizens, you know, when they're actually impacted by these actions, kind of start asking their representatives, their government, like, what the heck are you doing about this problem? And so I'm not sure that it always has the positive impact that they're hoping for in those cases.
Yeah. And I think just really quickly, Luke, just in you mentioned this sort of like a brand management thing too, right? As you know, we were talking about disruption efforts, as these big brands get disrupted and shift and rebrand, you know, there is also a degree, I don't know the degree to which this will truly pan out over the medium to long term, but there's a degree that our success at disruption may effectively lead to actors having, you know, fewer big brands to defend, right? So if you have to rebrand, if a small team of actors develop their own service, their own name, they're less bound by any of these norms that a larger organization may have adopted to sort of halt disruption efforts targeting the sort of network, right?
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think certainly changes kind of how or one way you could, one lens in which you view those rebrands and the reemergence of threat actors that we've seen in the past operate under a different name. I'm curious your thoughts on, go ahead, Kimberly, you had a point.
Yeah, I was just going to note too, like another thing to kind of think about here in terms of the actions that we take against threat actors, you know, they're obviously in this for the money, right? And so I think when we are looking at actions to take, like when we can focus on the money, I think that's really important because ultimately we want to make these operations the least profitable that we possibly can. It doesn't mean every threat actor is going to give up, but you know, if they're not able to cash out their funds, that's a pretty big impact that we can potentially have. And then just one other note would be that with all of these actions that we take, and to go back to that point too about, you know, the encouraging of the targeting of healthcare in response to actions that were taken against it, one of the risks that we have here is that there is a subset of actors who have become, you know, pretty aggressive with their communications with victims. And there is always that potential that you could significantly irritate them and they may retaliate in other ways other than, you know, just encouraging additional ransomware attacks.
So pivoting off that point and thinking about maybe some of our discussions last year, you know, viewing this all as the extortion space, so whether it's ransomware, and as organizations have got better at having and restoring from backups, the shift increasingly to also data theft, because once your data has been stolen and exfiltrated, that becomes a harder problem to deal with. It seems like threat actors are always looking for new ways they can monetize access to the victim environment in their network, right? That's always been the case. What are some other interesting trends, either from, I guess, the mechanics of the extortion activity or just even TTPs overall that we're seeing continue to evolve in this larger ecosystem? I keep using the word ecosystem, but, you know, like the larger, as an adversary motivation, this trend.
Yeah, so one of the things that we've kind of touched on here earlier, I think, is the idea that from, you know, when we did our sort of broad reporting on the state of ransomware and extortion in 2022, you know, the message that we came with was that it was a plateau of sorts, right? You know, we'd seen coming out of a couple of years of unprecedented growth, shifts in TTPs, lots of change, lots of disruption among the threat actors and what they were doing and how they were monetizing and what they were incorporating into their, you know, intrusions. And then in 2022, things seemed to really plateau. There were some changes, but not, you know, a huge number of dramatic ones. One of the notable changes we had noticed in last year's sort of overview that was interesting was that there was a significant decrease in the prevalence of Cobalt Strike Beacon, right, which had sort of loomed large on the ransomware intrusion scene for many years. We saw it actually sort of like decrease in prevalence from being seen at 60% of intrusions in 2021 to 40% in 2022. And then interestingly, we see that trend continuing at approximately that same rate now across 2023. So we've continued to see that decline. And what has been sort of like coming in and filling in the gap has been the use of legitimate remote access tools. So, you know, we saw a proportionate change in many degrees, in many senses, right? So in 2021, we saw very few of them across ransomware intrusions. And in 2022, we saw them at about a quarter of them. And then in 2023, you know, we're well over 25%, reaching up towards 40% of cases where we're seeing some type of a remote access tool being used at an intrusion. And so that shift has been pretty notable and I think has likely been driven by huge amounts of effort on the defender side to understand what, you know, common post-exploitation tools like Beacon look like in the environment, developing strong detections and tools and understandings of that. Whereas for many years, actors were able to get by using that without making notable changes to it. Right, using it more or less out of the box or with, you know, slight changes from open source tooling. Another trend that we've seen that's somewhat interesting in that is that we continue to see actors using sort of like a big four series of like network reconnaissance tools. And it's notable because with remote access tools, we see many, many, many different tools being used. And we've actually seen there's like a notable number of cases where we see actors bringing in two different legitimate remote access tools, three different legitimate remote access tools. When it comes to sort of like network reconnaissance, we see actors relying on a fairly small number of publicly available tools. That's NetScan, PScan, Advanced IP Scanner, and Advanced Port Scanner. You know, in 2021, we saw these across, you know, 20% of intrusions, which ballooned to slightly under 50% in 2022. The overall prevalence has decreased this year, but it's still those exact same tools being used across north of 30% of intrusions. So the story there isn't of continuous growth. It's of sort of the continuation of these very common, well-understood tools being seen across many of the intrusions that we are handling at Mandiant.
When you think back to that, your thoughts around that when we recorded this last year, some of the data points that we're seeing now, is there anything that surprises you or that you expected to see? I mean, it could be that piece of data or others that you think is remarkable.
Honestly, I think that of all the sort of technology trends that we're seeing, the change in Beacon, the decrease in the use of Beacon, the increase in the use of remote access tools isn't surprising. It is, it does make a lot of sense. And overall, the other trends speak really to an ecosystem of criminals that are using what they know and what they know that works, right? There hasn't really been a lot of requirement, it seems, to evolve their tooling. And that does sort of suggest to me that actors are, that defenders don't understand in many cases what the post-exploitation activity that precedes ransomware deployment really looks like. Because, you know, there hasn't been any major shifts over the last, you know, year and a half, 2 years.
I will make a bold conjecture, and I have not seen the MTrends data for this year, but I would guess even with the decline in usage of Beacon by ransomware-related threat actors, that might still be the most prevalent malware family that we saw across all threat activity, just because of its usage also amongst a lot of state-sponsored actors. But if I'm wrong, I'll have to come back and delete this portion of the podcast.
Well, I'm not sure what that data would say, but if we're going to stay, like it is now used by, again, nearing 20, only 20% of ransomware intrusions, which is a major change considering it was one of the sort of consistent across the board expectations from these kinds of intrusions historically. So, you know, I do know that espionage motivated actors have been picking it up, but they're going to have to pick it up quite a lot to make up for the difference.
And I think it was always one of the, you know, when you would see the usage of that tool, it was, I mean, the breadth of actors that utilized it made attribution, at least with just that to go off of, or in the early stages of an investigation, somewhat difficult because you had everything from criminal groups using it, APT29 has used it, and then also legitimate pen testers and red teamers. So it's historically been very ubiquitous, but it'll be interesting to see if that's now changing.
I think too, you know, even the use that we see of like legitimate remote access tools, the less reliance on malware, that even, you know, arguably, and Jeremy, you can chime in if you think I'm wrong, but that even makes attribution another increasing level of difficulty, right? Because in some of those cases, we aren't even necessarily having command and control infrastructure to be able to point back to look at the characteristics of that to help us with the attribution in some cases.
No, I mean, that's absolutely the case, right? We actually got very good at attributing actors based on their use of Cobalt Strike, whereas with legitimate remote access tools, there are some approaches, analytical approaches to doing it, but they're much more sparse.
So wrapping this all up and kind of, you know, looking out to the rest of this year, What are some thoughts you have on where this this industry, because I think, Kimberly, back to your point at the beginning, this has really become its own industry within cybercrime. Where do you think the extortion, ransomware, and data theft extortion industry goes into this year with some of the trends that we saw from last year, but then also what we're kind of continuing to see into early 2024?
Honestly, I think barring major external factors or barring additional chaos in the remote, sort of the ransomware as a service ecosystem that causes a more systemic impact to all the different teams of intrusion operators that associate to these services, it does seem like that story of sort of an industry-wide plateau through 2022-2023 is going to follow. I think that the major changes that we saw that sort of like led into that plateau around as Kimberly had mentioned, the war in Ukraine and the disruption of the Conti and TrickBot ecosystems. I think that, you know, barring major external events, you know, it does seem like this will continue to plateau and look similar to tomorrow to the way it does currently.
I think that, unfortunately, we're kind of in this situation where, you know, we were able to impact threat actors in certain ways, but not necessarily in the ways that make them stop, at least as of today, right? And so there are things that we can certainly consider doing, and by we, I mean, you know, the government can consider doing and continuously get a little bit more creative in the types of actions that they take against threat actors, and maybe simultaneously take actions against a lot of these groups at the same time, which, you know, might be able to stall them in terms of their ability to rebuild up quickly. But threat actors, at the end of the day, are making a lot of money from these types of attacks. And, you know, unless they're really behind bars, like, there's not necessarily a strong motivating factor for them to stop. And, you know, I think what my expectation, I guess, would be for this coming year is really a lot more of the same, at least from the ransomware ecosystem perspective. Perhaps, you know, we may see some more coordination, or we might see some new groups emerge or ransomware services emerge to kind of fill the voids of, you know, what the actions that law enforcement has taken in recent months. And so we might see new entrants like that. But in terms of these attacks significantly slowing down, that's not something that at least I'm expecting for this year without some significant impact or externally impacting event.
And it doesn't seem, while you still have it going on, that there's been other forms of cybercrime that have really taken off to a level to which there's a popularity there that would draw threat actors away from this. So, you know, crypto mining activity is still ongoing. It's still something that some threat actors do, maybe even in concert with some of these extortion operations, but that's not taken over as the more predominant, you know, threat vector, or things like point of sale malware, right? So it seems like if you really want to make a lot of money in the cybercrime, you know, community, this is where you're involved in some respect.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that. Like, we definitely haven't seen a lot of changes in the ways that threat actors monetize their operations. I look back at some of like the big trends, right? We had the large scale theft of payment card data. We had threat actors that were targeting financial institutions to change, you know, SWIFT payments to receive large sums of money that way. And now we have ransomware. And until we have another type of threat that, you know, can create equal amounts of revenue, I think we're kind of stuck with ransomware for the foreseeable future, unfortunately.
Yeah. And as we did with ransomware, we'll likely see it coming, right? The ecosystem doesn't shift on a dime. The shift from payment cards to sort of ransomware as a scheme took years. It wasn't a slow burn. And so likely there will be some evidence of the direction it's going before it gets there.
Yeah. And you'll see like some actors who are, you know, kind of like testing the waters, they become successful in this area, other threat actors see them making a lot of money, and thus then they start to do the same thing. And so, I mean, it is nice in that way, right? Like, you won't have everybody shifting all at once when they get to the point that they do shift, hopefully one day.
And I think that's always interesting to look back at. I want to say it was Maze at the very end of 2019 that was one of the first threat actors that had been doing ransomware to realize, wait a second, there's some interesting data here from this, you know, organization I compromised. What if I were to use that as a way to extort them and threaten to post it? And then you start to see others, you know, see that as a sort of proven business model and jump into that space. So, well, if we start to see emergence of those sort of new trends in the cybercrime landscape, we'll definitely have to have you guys both back on again sometime soon this year. So always good hearing your insights, though, Kimberly and Jeremy. And thanks for sharing them here today.